Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
London, 1382. The Crown's treasury, the most secure chamber in the kingdom, has been robbed, and 5 guards brutally killed. Brother Athelstan is set to investigate, but he has problems of his own, including a body found in the nave of his parish church. Join us as we speak with Paul Docherty about his recent Brother Athelstan medieval mystery, The Hanging Tree. You're listening to New Books in Historical Fiction, a channel of the New Books Network, and I'm your host, Michael Morales. Paul Docherty is the author of more than 80 highly acclaimed historical mysteries. He studied history at Liverpool and Oxford universities and is headmaster of a school in Essex. Paul, welcome to New Books in Historical Fiction.
Thank you very much. Good afternoon.
So, Paul, tell us about yourself and about your journey to writing medieval mysteries.
Yes, I was born in Middlesbrough, North Yorkshire. I went to different schools, went to university at Liverpool, and went to Oxford, where I got my doctorate. I'm not saying I'm an academic. I just thoroughly enjoyed myself there. One of the things I loved about history is the complete mystery which surrounds events. But my real journey, I always liked historical novels. I was brought up on Walter Scott, Victor Hugo. I just loved them. Yeah, Rosemary Sutcliffe, Henry Treece, Dickens, anything that took me back into history. Now, when I was at Oxford, I got into trouble because my supervisor, God bless him, pointed out to me that I was supposed to be writing a learned treatise, not a novel. And I think he really had me summed up because I maintained, I still do, that medieval barons and lords were no different from the mafia today. They were a powerful group. Anyway, I did my thesis on a very remarkable woman called Isabella. She was wife of Edward II. She was a daughter of Philip of France, who destroyed the Templars. And she put up with her husband's various escapades for about 20 years. In 1325, she fell foul of Hugh de Spencer, a new favourite at court. He's an ancestor of Diane Spencer. We don't know what really happened. I suspect that Hugh de Spencer wanted to get into bed with the Queen. There's a reference in a letter by the Pope to de Spencer saying he's heard something which he finds very difficult to accept. Isabella hated him and kept him at arm's distance. She then fled to France back to her brother. And there she joined an English exile, Roger Mortimer, who had also fallen foul of de Spencer. Anyway, to cut a long story short, they invaded England. Isabella moved slowly at first, but the country rose to support her, so she marched on London. Then she took a detour to the West Country, where she caught Hugh de Spencer and her husband. She sent her husband to Berkeley Castle in Gloucestershire. Hugh de Spencer, she executed at Hereford in a most horrific fashion while she had breakfast and watched. He was hanged, drawn, quartered. Edward was put into Berkeley Castle. According to the chroniclers, on September the 21st, the anniversary is coming soon, 1327, assassins entered the king's cell, turned him over on his face, and thrust a red-hot poker up into his innards. He was then, he died. he was then given a very lavish burial in nearby Gloucester Cathedral. And even today, you can visit the tomb there, Purbeck marble, absolutely marvellous example of medieval architecture and carving. And that was it. Edward was dead, Isabella was with her lover, everything was tickety-boo. But Mortimer had ideas, and he upset and alienated Isabella's eldest son, the future Edward III, the future warrior king. Basically, Mortimer was arrested in a coup d'etat one night at Nottingham Castle. He was, the king sent him south for a fair trial and then to hang him. Mortimer was gagged throughout his trial. He was the first man to be hanged at Tyburn, and he hung there for 3 days naked. Isabella is supposed to have had a nervous breakdown. So that's the story in the history books. However, in 1341, Edward III, Edward II's son, receives a letter. Your father's still alive, and I've heard his confession. And I thought, could he? Did he? Possible. We know the castle was stormed on at least two occasions. The corpse wasn't really given a good scrutiny. So anyway, I thought, no, there's a novel here. So I wrote my first novel, Death of the King, and took it from there. I suggested that Edward II did escape, went to Ireland, then to northern Italy, to the monastery of St. Alberto de Mutrio in the north. Yes, that started me on this idea of medieval mystery, which I love. And I love the medieval period because it's a period of contrasts. You know, you've got this beautiful Gothic architecture, marvellous cathedral, thousands of tons of masonry hanging in the air there for hundreds of years. Tiled floors, statues, paintings, triptychs. And you leave the church, you see a gallows with two or three people hanging from it by the neck. And what catches me about the medieval period is the bustling energy. You know, people really, English, Chaucer captures it in his prologue to Canterbury Tales. You know, all off on a pilgrimage in April. You know, let's go to Canterbury. That's a really, it's a jolly boys outing. You know, I mean, you get all these mysterious characters, sort of the pardoner, the miller. And this, that's a path in to a world which I find absolutely fascinating. And of course, the greatest challenge, or the greatest insult, or the greatest offence one can commit is murder. Basically, a murderer says, I will murder you, Michael, and then I will wipe my lips and I will pretend to be totally and utterly innocent. That's a challenge. You know, it goes right back to the beginning of time when God says to Cain, where's your brother? And Cain says, I don't know where he is. Cain knows full well where he is. He killed him. Yes? So, my novel's about the sons and daughters of Cain, people who think they can wipe out a life and walk away. And it's a challenge. And so I had a clerk, Hugh Corbett. You see, the clerks of the medieval period, they were usually graduates of Oxford and Cambridge, the halls there. They entered the royal service. The king depended on them very heavily. Yeah, they were called mailed clerks. They often fought in battle. But they were men usually of integrity. They were chosen by the king, promoted by the king, and they were totally devoted to the crown. So if you wanted to investigate something, then you send them on your clerks. Now, Hugh Corbett's based on a real character, John Drockensford. Drockensford was a local boy from the West Country who made good. I've seen the records. His parents were absolutely proud of him. John was you know, he was a high, he rose to become a high-ranking civil servant. I came across Drockensford because in 1305, the gangs of London, led by one man, Richard Pudlicott, decided to break into the Royal Treasury. Now, the Royal Treasury wasn't in the Tower. The crown jewels were kept in the crypt of Westminster Abbey. And this is still there, below ground, spiral staircase. Half the staircase was removed. You had to have a wooden staircase put in so you could continue your journey down. Everything was there. You name it. With the jewels, the crowns, including the dagger that an assassin in the Middle East had tried to kill the king with, the guild of assassins, the group of assassins. Anyway, all the treasure was down there. Pudlicott corrupted the monks. He brought in booze at night, the wine, ladies of the town, you know, chat, watching telly, all the rest, yeah? And a mobs, meanwhile, his mates outside were digging furiously. because the crypt had one week, and you can still see it today. It had a window with iron bars down. They chipped away at the cement in which the iron bars were embedded and managed basically to create a gap, just forced the bars back, and then they could literally slide down into the crypt. They got in, they nicked the stuff. Some of them were drunk. They dropped some of it on the way out, and they fled. Edward the First of who fought Scots, Braveheart fame, the famous film. He went berserk. He had a furious, horrific temper, as his son found out. But Edward sends Drakensberg down to Westminster to investigate. He knows there's something very wrong. The whole of the underworld of London's gone silent. So what he does, he teams up with the constable of the Tower of London, an old soldier, a favourite of Edward I, and they literally move around London empaneling juries, like a grand jury system. What do you know about the robbery? And you get all sorts of people singing all sorts of songs. You know, you get someone saying, oh yes, Cecily the courtesan, she received a necklace from Brother X of Westminster Abbey, so that she would become his friend. Now, you can read between the lines what friend means. And Drakensberg closes a gap. He's forcing the outlaws, and eventually public court breaks cover. He flees for sanctuary in a church. All these elements of medievalism. Says, I'm in church now, you can't touch me. Drakensberg, however, is determined. He pays some men. He says, look, never mind what the church says. Never mind about excommunication. You get in there, nick him, and bring him out to me. And they do that. Pudlicott's then taken to the Tower to be tried before a special commission. He's found guilty. And he's taken to a wheelbarrow back down to Westminster, where he's hanged. Some people claim that he was then skinned, and the skin pinned to a door in Westminster Abbey as a warning to the monks. Now, that is not Paul Doherty fiction. That happened. That really, I've seen the documents. Yeah, and these people were having a glorious time of it. And they turned on each other. I've come across a confession by one John Rippinghale. Rippinghale was a typical underworld character of the Middle Ages. Former priest, clerk on the run, wanted here, there, and he tries to save his skin, literally, by confessing to a whole series of crimes that never committed. And he gives a view of the plot which never, ever occurred. So, Michael, what I'm saying is, and I hope you can follow me, is you take an incident like the great Jew robbery, and you've got everything there. I mean, you know, you wouldn't believe it. It's better than fiction. Yes, these people lying, fighting, betraying, and all of them displaying quite incredible courage. Now, that is a marvellous forum in which to investigate medieval murder mysteries. And Drakensberg becomes Hugh Corbett. Hugh Corbett's the clerk. All clerks are a dagger man. They always had a hitman. And Corbett has this in Ranulph at Newgate. Former felon, a man who knows the underworld, knows London, quick on his feet, able swordsman, a dagger man, someone who watches his master's back. And these two were very much like a marshal in the Wild West. Yeah, well, and they had some complete power. Because what they'd be doing, they'd carry a commission with a king's seal on. Yeah, or they'd even have a document that said, whatever the bearer of this document wants, give it to him. Whatever he asks you a question, answer him. So that's the world I move in. And there's Corbett. And of course, there's Athelstan. Athelstan, again, the church, the state, the crown, was dependent on priests. Priests were learned and educated. And I thought this combination of characters with Cranston, the Lord High Coroner, and his secretarius, Athelstan. And Athelstan, his parish priest, because there's a story behind him, of this parish in St. Erkin's Wall, which is full of every kind of villain under the sun. You must remember, these were men who'd fought in France. They'd fought with the armies of the crown. And they were not known for their finesse, their care, or their compassion. And they came home. So all of these parishioners have stories, which you can activate whenever you want.
Now, on your website, there's a picture of you receiving the OBE, Order of the British Empire. Tell us about that experience.
Yeah, I got it because of my good looks.
That was my first guess.
Thank you, Michael. Plusley will get you. No, far from it. I think I received it because of contribution to education, including my novels. It was a wonderful, wonderful morning. Her Majesty was very gracious. Buckingham Palace was lovely. I can always say I've been to the toilet at Buckingham Palace at least 5 times just to see what it was like. It was very good. And it was a great day out. That, you know, it was lovely to receive. It's a great honour. And so, I'm grateful for it. I'm also cognizant that, you know, probably I'll be also being rewarded for other people's work. But it was an honour, and it was lovely to meet the Queen. I mean, to actually shake the hands of a woman who, you know, met the Kennedys, Khrushchev, all the great, the good, and not so good of the 20th, 21st century. Lovely.
Many, like myself, love medieval settings for stories, especially for mysteries. Would you describe the setting for The Hanging Tree? What era are we talking about, and what's going on in England in terms of politics and cultural life?
It's the winter of 1382. There's the great revolt of 1381, the peasants' revolt, has been really and cruelly crushed. Yeah, the lords of the soil, the great ones, are in power again. John of Gaunt is the regent for the young King Richard II. London's recovering. Many of the leaders of the revolt have either legged it, ran, or have been hanged. The Hanging Tree is it's two murder stories interlocked. It's one is the theft of money from Westminster. And again, thievery was common. And I'm glad to be able to do it because, as you know, in London now we've got what's called Lombard Street. That's where the bankers were. And the Crown depended on these bankers for money. Basically, the Crown's going to pay money back. The money's taken. Meanwhile, Athelstan had got problems of his own in Southwark. He's also been challenged by a series of murders in a rather gruesome tavern known as the Hanging Tree. And that's as far as I want to say that. You know, it's just these two worlds are interlinked, yes? It's fast-moving. Violence becomes personal. People do not want Athelstan to interfere. I try to take my reader and say, look, let's walk through medieval London, and you're going to hear stories that you will fascinate you. I want someone to say, yes, I went back in time with Paul Doherty. That's what a Hanging Tree is.
Athelstan is probably my favorite of your characters in your various series. Tell us about him.
He's a complex character, very complex. He is, again, son of a yeoman farmer, sort of the backbone of England. Like all young men then, were attracted by the wars in France. And he takes his brother off with him. Of course, the wars in France were not really the wars in France. They were hard, bitter battles, particularly in Athelstan's era, where the English were on their back foot and being defeated. Athelstan took his brother Francis there. His brother gets killed. Athelstan comes home. His parents, of course, are heartbroken. Athelstan then undergoes some sort of metamorphosis, a character change, a repentance. He holds himself responsible for his brother's death. He journeys around. We know, like the one I'm writing now, he does have an affair. He does meet women. He is Athelstan is very much attracted to women, as we found out in the novel with the woman Benedicta in the parish. But really, Athelstan is devoted. He believes he has a vocation to the priesthood. He then joins the Dominican order. Dominicans, literally Dominicanes, hounds of God. They ran the Inquisition, but there were also people who worked with the poor. They blended in with the poor. And Athelstan is only one of these. And he says to his order, I want to do something really sort of basic, radical. And so the headquarters of the Dominicans at Blackfriars across the Thames, we've just got a place for you. Yeah, a parish for which no one will volunteer. So then Nicholas Walls, off he goes. He's a complex character. He believes in the basic goodness of a man, but he says you've got to be prudent. You know, you've got to be watchful. You've got to be careful. And he works there. He buries the dead. He celebrates Mass. And, of course, he has these parish councils which did exist. And like today, people took them very seriously. You know, the matters of the parish, where would a statue go? And above all, of course, what Athels and Dreads are the plays. They loved mystery plays. And of course, there'd be a debate over who would play what. And of course, their knowledge of scripture wasn't very good. Yeah, in this present novel, I'm saying Watkin, the dung collector, believes a heron married Pontius Pilate. No, you've got it wrong. This is the way we do it. And then this, you know, relic sellers appearing. No, I mean, somebody said there was enough wood of the true cross to build a fleet of ships. You know, you get the pathos, you get the tragedies, and Athelstan blends in with this. He likes his little comfort. He's got his own little house. He's got a cat, which has adopted him, Bonaventure. He's got an old horse, Philomel. He's got Hubert the Hedgehog. He's got a massive cemetery to manage, which he finds really daunting, especially when two of his parishioners, Cecily the courtesan and Clarissa, spend most of their time in the cemetery entertaining their clients. So he's got all this is all going on all the time. You know, I enjoy writing about it.
I saw in your biography that you had studied for the priesthood. Does that background inform your portrayal of Athelstan?
So, yeah, I mean, I did theology, philosophy, canon law. I thought I had a vocation. I mean, I came from a typical Irish Catholic family. I soon found out I hadn't. Nevertheless, I enjoyed the experience. It's strange, isn't it, Michael? A lot of what I read there appears in my novels now. You know, particularly about church, about sanctuary, about canon law, about priests. Benefit of clergy. That's another wonderful thing about medieval period. Michael, if we could recite the first line of Psalm 50, "Have mercy on me, O God, in your great kindness, in your infinite compassion, brought out my offense, we were home and dry, they couldn't hang us." Yeah, that was benefit of clergy. Because the church is very strict on this, following the death and murder of Becket, you do not touch clerics, you do not touch priests. So this... Yeah, a lot of what I learned, a lot of what I studied, some of the homilies, some of the saints I met in the books, a lot of the debates about morality. Yeah, it provided a good layer for the novels, yes.
Now, everyone knows the best mysteries are locked room mysteries, and you are the king of locked room mysteries. In The Hanging Tree, you set up a particularly amazing scenario. Would you describe that for us?
I don't want to give the solution, Michael. It's just basically they have to go through one door, down one set of steps, and through another door into a treasure chamber. Yes? Those who commit the murders get in, get out with the wealth and the murder, but the doors are locked. So all I can say, Michael, it's not easy. If you sit and watch people, I was sitting in a hotel recently, in the entrance hall, waiting for someone, and I watch people giving their keys back. You know what I mean? All it needs, Michael, just pick up the wrong set of keys. Yes, I go upstairs, I unlock the door, I wait for you to return. Yeah, I'm a hitman, I carry out the hit. Yes, I close the door, lock it, take the key down, you know, put it on the counter. The clerk takes it up, throws. What I'm saying, Michael, is that's just a fairly, simple example. Locked room mysteries, by definition, aren't really locked room mysteries, are they? Because someone must have got out somehow. Yeah. The trick is what we think we see, we don't see. And what our simple gestures can often be extremely important. Handing over a key. Well, look, Michael, test it. Next time you're in a hotel, you know, you're sitting in the atrium, you're sitting in the entrance hall, yeah? Watch what people do. I've seen recently, I was in Malta, I watched them put keys down, walk away. And it's these little, that is where you fasten. I mean, maybe I should, yeah. Like there's one where someone's poisoned in the room. Yes, this person, this is what I was tackling last night, I was actually lying in bed looking at the ceiling. This person's poisoned, it's definitely a poison. It's definitely one of these common, the most powerful poisons, Michael, was grown in your garden. Yeah, some of the most deadliest there out there. Now, we know that when he went in that room, he had a goblet of wine. We know that he drank the wine there. We know that someone else took a sip from that cup. So for no ill effect. But the victim locks the door and he is found definitely poisoned. So how does the poison get into the cup? Oh, tell you
about that. Oh, now we'll have to wait for you to publish the solution. Now, in addition to being set in the medieval era and to involving a locked room, your mysteries also possess a third essential. They have fair, satisfying resolutions.
Thank you.
Some authors resort to fanciful solutions or to facts hidden from readers, or they basically make every character suspect. So it's a roll of the dice as to which one is really guilty. How do you go about constructing your mysteries?
I think you've got to be fair to your reader. You know, I think the reader says, oh, I missed that. You know, yeah, of course, yeah. I don't think it's right for the reader to think, well, you know, that could have been anybody. Yes. You know, Ronald Knox, the Catholic priest, he wrote, was it the Ten Commandments of Writing a Murder Mystery? And you've got to be logical. It's unfair to have the murderer, someone mentioned on page one and then never mentioned again. But it's taxing. I'm always thinking, I mean, goodness, you know, the number of times I think about murder, Michael, it's a good job you can't be arrested for that. Otherwise, I'd be doing a life sentence. Yes.
So you're also a headmaster in addition to being an author. When do you find time to write, and how much time are you able to devote to writing?
I read a report, psychologist, like a psychiatrist. We spend 20% of our waking time just thinking. I said, that's quite a big chunk. And what I do, I think, and I get the plot up here. Like the murder, you just described the poison. I think, yeah, yes, that's good. And then I just make sure that I use the time properly. Yeah, I write my novel, I handwrite it, then I dictate to my secretary at home. And I like doing that because you can hear the words coming out. You can hear music. Words have a music. You make sure that you're not using the same word two or three times. Yes? He had a passion. He had a fervor, you know. That's the way. I just, bearing in mind, Mike, and don't forget, that murder mysteries, by definition, tend to be between about 80 to 100,000 words. Any longer, you start thinking, well, the detective must be thick or stupid. They're taking so long. And the other thing, I am slowing up simply because I try to make each novel unique. I don't think it's right for novel 3 to reappear in novel 10. It's, yes, you've got to have a unique plot, unique setting, different things. You know, like in this next, I'm doing my next Athelstan now, Sir John Cranston's challenge to a duel, which is quite, someone calls him a liar. Yeah, and that has to be answered. Yes? And at the same time, there's a master thief loose in London. Yes. There's one other series I'm doing. It's not so much murder mystery. I'm fascinated by Richard III, his brother Edward IV. And, you know, I've got a new series, Margaret Beaufort. Yeah? And it grew because, again, I've been thinking this for decades. In 1471, the Yorkist armies in England, under Edward and Richard, the future Richard III, they smashed the opposition. They absolutely annihilated them at two great battles in 1471. One was at Tewkesbury in the West Country. One was in Barnet, just north of London, then not far from where I'm sitting now. And Edward IV brought them to battle, destroying them. He didn't take prisoners. Yeah, the Lancastrians fled for sanctuary in Tewkesbury Abbey. Then Edward didn't give a damn. He had them dragged out the following day, decapitated. Edward, the Yorkist, was supreme. Yeah, Edward IV had a lovely wife, Elizabeth. He had two sons, daughters. He was well stocked there. Yes, he'd crushed all opposition. However, by 1483, all this had crumbled. And eventually, the Yorkists collapsed at Bodsworth in 1485, where, as you know, Richard III was defeated and killed, and the Lancastrians, Henry Tudor, swept to power. And I thought, somebody was behind this. I get this impression of someone deep plotting York's destruction. And I chose Margaret Beaufort, mother of Henry, who was a very, very bright lady, very sharp, very learned. She founded colleges at Cambridge and very clever. And she was aided by a clerk called Christopher Urswick. And some people maintain Christopher Urswick is the father of our modern Secret Service. But we do know that Margaret, you know, then she was very cunning. And I'm thinking the destruction of the Yorkists is laid at her door. She is this pious lady, you know, that doing good, but all the time. There's really two Margarets. One is the pious lady of court, and the other is the Lancastrian princess working very hard for her son, as he did succeed to the throne. I enjoy it. Enjoy Erswick and enjoy Margaret.
Now, we know chefs don't like giving away their recipes, but would you, as an author, give us some insight into your method? Do you work out the plot from beginning to end, or do you leave room for surprises? Do you write in an open-ended way? What is your process of writing like?
You get a main line. You get a main line, I admit, something to carry the plot. And you must have enough to carry it forward, Mike. That's why many people give up writing. They reach halfway. And it's like a plane running out of fuel. They can't take it further. So what you do is you also let the story take its turn. And take its time. So things... I've just finished a Margaret Beaufort. And as I wrote it, a character that was just an ordinary character began to emerge as someone very important. Yes? And I think I've done it. I think it's... So in other words, to answer your question, you have a pretty good idea where you're going. What one of the funds of writing, you think, oh... I'll do a turn on this. I'll contradict, you know, I'll do this, do that. Well, that person can die. Well, that person can be removed. So that's part of the joy of writing. If it's too planned, don't forget, if I plan it too much, I might be able to know the path, but so does everybody else. You want to mislead. You're going to deliberately mislead people, I'm sorry, yeah? You're going to entertain them so that they think, oh, crikey, I didn't think that would happen. Yes, how do you make sure the characters you're dealing with are rounded, that they too have private lives, private thoughts, etc. I hope that helps, Michael.
Paul, it's been a delight spending time with you and talking about The Hanging Tree. Thank you for being with us.
Michael, you're a gentleman and a scholar. And as Athelson would say, pax et bonum.
Yes, pax et bonum. Friends, you've been listening to New Books in Historical Fiction, the channel of the New Books Network. Until next time, goodbye.